Hi, everybody. Can you take your seats? We're going to get going. So I'm Steve Eisler, and this is the Finding Your Passion, panel number 3617. We're in Camp 140 on Wednesday at 2 o'clock. And the conference has asked me to read something, so this will facilitate our Q&As at the end. In this CWA session, we're utilize both the CWA app and note card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask your question in the app, simply select the session in the schedule tab, live Q&A, and then insert your question. You may also raise your hand at any time to request a note card and a pencil from one of our producers, then give your question to the producer. If you're a student, put student at the top of your question and we'll ask your questions first. There we go. So I'm going to introduce our panelists. David Wilcox will speak first. Something tender about David, his dad just passed away. And in these times, he spent a lot of time discovering things about his own heart. John Houston will speak next. John could eat Mexican food every day. And he's super in love with his twins, whose first birthday is this coming Sunday. Joe Hagan, another one of our wonderful luminaries, when he gets bored with bureaucracy, he likes to go to a construction site. He likes to see things getting built. Surreal is super in love. That's all you get out of her. That boy, I think she said that to keep you away. And Ernie Watts loves working in his garden. Lives in California, and he's got a good growing season. We'll start with David Wilcox now. Thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
Now, if you were to listen really carefully, you might be able to hear this guitar. What do you think? No? Finding your passion. That's different than once you know your passion, how do you find your way into or through or around your passion? I'm going to leave it on the guitar because I have this guitar. So, finding your passion. Fascinating topic, I think. When I went off to college, I was going to be a physics major. I loved how stuff worked. I wanted to design stuff and fix stuff and learn about how things worked. I loved coefficient of friction. I loved polar moment of inertia. I loved stuff that was just like learnable. I showed up to college and there was a woman playing guitar at the end of the stairwell and I stopped. I couldn't see her, but I could hear that echo up the staircase, that concrete staircase. It sounded so live. Not so much for me, I wasn't so alive. But there was something in my heart that said, oh, what's that? I came to that guitar as if I wanted to know my own heart. And that's still why I come to the guitar. I have a practice of writing. I show up in the quiet room and I face the empty page as if I'm asking the question, what do I need to know? And I'm asking my own heart. I'm asking, like, what are the things I need to say before it's too late? I'm asking the questions, what do I need to see before it's gone? I'm asking the questions, what am I taking for granted? How am I not living as fully as I can? I ask these questions to the empty page in the quiet room, and with the excuse of guitar, I have an opportunity to feel and then slowly discern, line by line, as I craft a song that seems to be speaking what I don't have words to say. It seems to be showing me a scene of a place I haven't hiked to yet. It seems to be showing me something that's more alive than I am. And I say, I want that. I would like to sing you a song that is about this miraculous thing that happens where we set off on this journey with not much to go on, but just, I feel slightly more alive here when I do this, when I think this, when I do, when I try this. And this song is written as if it's just a love song. It's written as if it's just about meeting someone who you are just so alive around. In this song, it's not the kind of a person you could have and hold. It is the kind of person who makes you know how much heart you have by meticulously breaking your heart open. And of course, human hearts don't work until they're broken open. So this is a song that seems to be about just what to do when you have finally experienced being that alive. Because it's two choices, really. You either have to try to forget that that's possible for the rest of your life so you can acclimate to something than something less than life. Or you have to remember that that's possible for the rest of your life, and that takes a whole lot of music. So this is a song about that pursuit. My favorite part is somewhere in the third verse where our hero sets off in pursuit of this mystical sense of vibrant, alive adventure. And in the lyric, it says something about, I set off following a fragrance that was carried on the wind. I mean, she's got like a 9-hour head start, and he's in hot pursuit, following what? A fragrance on the wind? Good luck! Oh, you won't need luck. You can find it. It's a game of warmer, cooler. You know the game? The blindfold game? All your friends say, warmer, warmer, as you walk toward the goal. Oh, colder, freezing! Except it's your own heart speaking. How do you find your passion? How do you discern more alive from less alive? Ah. The night I saw her dancing, she moved in liquid music, like every song that moved us was the music of her soul. Waking up at sunrise, the sunlight through her window pulled aside the curtain far away from home. When she danced, she knew the music, like the waving of a wheat field gives a hidden wind away. And I'm so grateful for her beauty. I knew she could not stay. All of us in our lives are kind of like the people standing at the back of the room. Turn around. They're right there. And they know that there's empty seats. And they're right up here in the front. And if you want them, you have to come get them. Find your passion. Come on down. Lives are in the balance. So, in our first verse, we had our hero fall madly in love. What happens next? Can't wait to find out. Let's listen. It's the fragrance of her memory, the satin and the velvet. Time split through a prism, and I knew that she was gone. And I found the note she'd written. My heart could dare to trust her. The journey in the darkness, she'd be with me in the dawn. And she what you did, babe. He knew she could not stay, and he knew he couldn't live without it. What'd you do? Well, I can't wait to find out. So I stepped out on the sidewalk, closed the door behind me, following the fragrance that was carried on the wind. Knew I'd never reach her, 'cause the starlight was the distance. But I knew that right beside me was where she'd always been. Now when we dance, she moves right through me. I trust that love is coming to me from the promise that she gave. And I'm so grateful for her beauty. Why? 'Cause it made my heart so brave. 'Cause it made my heart so brave. Everything I've ever done that was any worth, I did in pursuit of that beauty. So finding your passion isn't like how to conquer it, how to know it, how to hold it, how to own it. When I come to the guitar, I don't want to manipulate the strings to do what I want. I come to the instrument and I say, what do you know that I don't? What I want to practice is that place of unknowing. What I want to practice is that place of wonder. So, find your passion. Remember the times you were most alive. Feel deeply the way that felt and how it was different. You slowly learn to differentiate the subtle differences, not just in the extremes, but oh, I'm a little off track now. I'm a little off track. You don't wait until your heart calls a strike and shuts down the whole function that we call depression. You listen sooner when your heart says, I'm just a little bored, okay? And you say, tell me more. You don't offer it a distraction. You let yourself feel the quiet and you say, tell me more. What do you want to feel? Describe it. Tell me what it tastes like. Tell me everything you know about when you were more alive and what that was like. And slowly you build the subtle discernment that makes the turns finer. When you're learning to ride a unicycle, at first you just are suddenly lying on the ground and the unicycle's off in the bushes somewhere and you think, I don't even know what happened. And little by little, you learn to catch yourself sooner until you're in what I call the easy chair, which means that you're making the corrections so early that you don't even notice you're making them. It feels like you're not on one wheel. It feels like you got five or six. You're just like stable. You're just going down the road. You know, it's easy. And what you have learned is, oh, I'm slightly out of balance. Instead of, I'm completely on the ground. Finding your passion is learning the subtle distinction of when I felt most alive.
I just learned something. Never follow up somebody holding a guitar.
Yeah.
So, I do polar expeditions. I've been to the North Pole, the South Pole, high Arctic, Canada, and Greenland. And if someone had come to me when I was a child or in college earlier in life and told me, hey, John, I'm going to be polar explorer and do polar expeditions all over the world, I would be like, that sounds awesome. How the hell is that going to happen? And that sort of looking back at my younger self is something I use today still, where I say, okay, if I look back at my own life and I put myself in the history of my life and look, oh, John, you're going to be moving to Boulder, which will happen in September. My younger self, I think, would be pretty happy with that decision. So I kind of try to look at my decisions in life through that lens sometimes to keep me on track. When I was a little boy, I asked my parents to read me the Kon-Tiki story over and over and over. There was something about that story that just totally captured my heart. And later on in childhood, I dug up the backyard trying to be Indiana Jones. And I even went on to study archaeology in college. And I loved the fieldwork. I loved working in small teams in remote areas, reconstructing stories of the past. But I really didn't have that same sort of love for the academic side of archaeology. At the same time, I was studying history in college, and I kind of fell in love with these, what I call universal stories of people achieving great things throughout history or overcoming seemingly insurmountable odds. And also in college, I went to Northwestern University, which is an urban university, and I helped start a new student program that is like a mini Apple golf course for new students. So in summary, things are starting to come together, but didn't really have a career in mind yet. And I was pretty good at math. I did well in an economics class, and the professor called me in after class, and they said, no, John, you should be an economics major. And it would have been very easy to say, yes, I'm going to do that. But it didn't really feel like, didn't light my fire. It didn't feel like who I was or what I wanted to be. So I ended up trying to piece together an outdoor career of some sorts. I love being in the outdoors. I knew I loved working with people in the outdoors and being kind of an instructor or leader of people in the outdoors, getting time away from normal civilization to reflect on our lives. And I tried to be a rock climber and found that I really wasn't that good of a rock climber. And I ended up signing on to work at Outward Bound in Far River, Minnesota, in a small town called Ely. I'm still kind of casting around. What I knew I was in the right realm, but really didn't have my fit yet. I signed on as a canoeing instructor. I've never been in a canoe. And that worked out pretty well. I still wanted to be in the mountains, so I thought. And then that winter, I was hired on happenstance through random luck to be part of the winter expedition program out of Rough. And I'll never forget the first day I got behind a dog sled. And I don't know if you've ever been dog sledding, but the power and innate energy and excitement that these dogs have for doing what they do and what they live to do is a totally awesome sight to witness and be a part of. And as soon as those dogs launched out the gate with me hanging on for dear life behind in minus 25 weather, with my nostrils freezing up, I was like, this is what I want to be doing. And those sled dogs just pulled me in and in and in. I was an intern that year, and I remember caretaking for the dog yard, which is one of our primary jobs as interns. Feeding the dogs, scooping poop of 60 dogs once a day. It's frozen, it's not that bad. Our dog yard was about a quarter mile from the canteen at our Outward Bound base. And I just remember, I was never a dog person as a kid, we had cats. And I remember how excited I was about doing those dog chores. We wore heavy boots in the winter, they're called Mickey Mouse boots, they're military surplus boots that are waterproof and very heavy. They're about 2.5 pounds each. So I'd strap those on my feet, and I would sprint that quarter mile to the dogs every single night. So I was so excited to get there. I felt like a kid. I felt this sort of energy just feels so right and so engaging to me. I loved the people I was working with, but it was really those dogs that brought me, that really helped me. And soon I fell in love with winter expeditioning and being out in the real deal wilderness of the winter time, where it can be in a very, really not that geographically remote place in the winter, a place where hundreds of thousands of people may travel in the boundary waters in the summertime, but very, very few people travel in the wintertime. It just felt so real. And that helped me as well, opening people's eyes up to winter helped me. And I found that I was challenged in the right way. I wanted more. I felt happy. I felt that the people around me could be mentors in my life, and I think that was a key. Hooking up and connecting with people who knew more than I did, who were veterans of the field, a fielder, and one or the other that I was a part of. Hooking up with those people, it was just fantastic. A lot of those people have become friends to me. And I started reading about historic polar expeditions, and I was just captivated. I went back to those history classes in college of these universal stories of people solving problems through history that could translate to our own lives. And I read about Norwegian expeditions that were aquatic expeditions that used humility as the main tool to survive and put a team together, put multi-dimensional teams where people learn as they go on these expeditions. And it all just kept going, feeling right to me. I kept going. I was eventually drafted by a team of Norwegians to rerun the original race for the South Pole on Greenland. Spent 72 days on Greenland skiing on 8-foot wooden skis. And I just think that I kept really pushing for those opportunities when doors were open for me and seizing it 100%. Feeling that those decisions weren't really decisions. It's just like, okay, this is the place I want to go. This makes so much sense to me. It speaks to my heart. It speaks to myself as a learner and as someone who wants to continue being challenged and learn throughout life. So I think that's an important part of finding my passion. It wasn't something that I wanted to sit still with. It was something that I wanted to see what might exist out there and see it as a journey and treat that journey as the goal of itself and be very open to where that journey would take me. And I thought that if I was with the right people and I had the right feelings in my gut and my heart about where I was and what I was doing on a daily basis and what I was thinking about, that would end up in the right place. And I just keep going back to that. And I've also found as my career has advanced that it is a daily thing sometimes that, am I thinking about the right things today? Am I putting myself in the right environments outside or around the right people where I am happy and stimulated and challenged in the way I want to be challenged? Or do I find myself kind of being lazy and saying, okay, I can make money doing this, or this is comfortable. How long do I want to keep doing those things? If I would go back into my younger self at some point and say, hey, this is where you are at this point in life, or is that a good place? And sometimes I do that. And I'm going, well, yeah, maybe that younger person would say, hey, you need to make some decisions to move on or change something about that daily existence or that aspect of my career. So thanks for listening to that, and I'll pass it on to my fellow Chicagoan.
Session, and I thought it would be my easiest one until I saw who's on the panel. Follow your passion. You know, I remember that. My kids would, when they were growing up, would say, Dad, what should I do? And I'd say, follow your passion. And that was the extent. So, how did I end up doing what I'm doing? So, I came up with four words, and hopefully I'll follow it. The first was construction. The second was neighborhood. The third was follow the money. and the fourth is third from the bottom. So as I was growing up, I come from a large family of 10 kids, and my cousins had 14, and my dad and my uncles and my grandfather had a steel erection business. They called it Hagen Brothers Erectors. Now, I know there's a joke there, I won't go there, but anyway. But as we were growing up, OSHA didn't exist. We would go out on job sites and literally climb steels, shimmy up. We would, when our fathers and my uncles were watching, we were running cranes. We were doing all that. I got so fascinated with construction. It got into my blood. So my dad always insisted, I don't want you to be in construction. I don't want you to be an iron worker. Go on and do something important. He kept emphasizing it to me. And one day we were driving down the road in Youngstown, Ohio, and this big, huge steel plant called, not the steel plant, but an automobile plant called Lordstown. And as we looked, I looked at Lordstown, I looked over, and there was this public housing site that looked horrible. He said, I said, what's going on with that? He goes, they need somebody like you to fix it. And I remember he always said that, and I kind of forgot about it. And so I ended up going, I got drafted, it was 2 years in the Army, came out of the Army, and I started college. And right around the time, that time, I got really fascinated about neighborhoods and what was happening in neighborhoods. They were deteriorating. People were moving out of really good, great neighborhoods. Why was that happening? So I sort of started designing my own curriculum based upon what I wanted to know. I started out going to the geography department and says, I want to know about urban geography. How can I learn more about it? Why are people moving out of neighborhoods? What's happening? And then they said, well, you need to know more about economics. So I started doing a lot of courses in economics and finally political science. Because when you talk about cities, you talk about neighborhoods, all three of those things are connected. And so when I got out of college, the first thing I did is I became a city-county planner. And along the way, I started learning more and more things. And I just kept looking around and saying, the only way that we're going to make a change is with a lot of capital. We have to figure out a way to get a lot of capital into neighborhoods. And finally, in 1986, Congress passed the Tax Reform Act, and there's a code in there called Section 42, and it's called the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program. And Congress said, I'll tell you what, if you build housing, and you make sure that the housing for people who earn below a certain income, and you charge a certain rent, and you keep it affordable for 30 years, we'll give an investor tax credits that they get over 10 years. And I'm looking at this, I didn't quite understand it. It was all tax code. I was trying to figure out how in the world it's going to work. And we worked with a couple of folks. And finally, they said, the only way it'll work is you have to get investors to invest in this program. And I'm thinking, geez, all the money. How can we figure out how to get investors to get interested in this? And I remember being a really naive person walking into a bank and telling them that I need $1 million from you and I'm going to give you a 13% return. And they look at me and go, what are you talking about? I got this tax credit program. And it was a really complicated thing, and thank God for PowerPoint. Because if it wasn't for PowerPoint back then, I would never have been able to explain this. I could have flow charts, and I finally got pretty good at it. And finally one day, I remember in Columbus, Ohio, Bank One said, we'll give you $1 million. And so, and then from there, we said, we got to figure out how to do more and more of this. And finally, I ended up running a company called the National Equity Fund. The National Equity Fund is in the business of raising capital, and we've raised a lot of capital. It's all about following the money. And the first time, the year that Ohio Capital was formed, we raised $8 million. From there, I went to work for the National Equity Fund, and basically, last year we raised $1 billion of capital that went into some 96 deals across the United States that represents close to $2 billion of development. So I talked a little bit about the idea of having a passion about following. I love construction. So one of the things I get to do is every one of these deals has some form of construction. So we have 148 people that work for us all across the United States. NEF has invested in 330 different cities, about 1,200 different projects. But one of the things that I talk about third from the bottom, I think my real benefit in making all this happen is the fact that I was third from the bottom of a family of 10, that I was used to chaos. There are two different types of large families than when you grew up in. You had the one large family that it was run like it was your, the Army sergeant was a mom. You did everything you needed to do when you needed to do it, or like my family, where it's total chaos. You literally would wake up and you don't know what was going to happen. And you know, when I was at the age of 6, it was my job to put the toast into the oven, the broiler, and make sure that I didn't burn it, because then my brothers and sisters would beat me up. So, but I learned from that the ability to, A, be able to talk to people and to make sure that the folks that I manage enjoy working where they work. So I have the benefit of saying I touch a lot of lives by going out and making affordable housing. People that are homeless, families that have not been able to afford housing. I mean, one of the best things that I do is I go to Rubicon ceremonies. Not many, because I would spend all my days in the road. But I remember one of the first deals that I closed in Ohio. And it was, we were able to do this three-bedroom townhouse. And we talked about how great it was. It took us almost 3 years to get it done. And I was walking by, and this woman was crying. She just was crying. She was weeping. And I go, what's wrong? Are you okay? Do you need anything? She goes, I have a wife. I have an unbelievable three-bedroom unit. My kids are going to be able to enjoy school. I don't have to worry about my housing anymore. That is something that will stay with you forever. And that's part of what I think that I'm blessed to be able to find something that was very, very passionate for me. So if you're looking for something that's interesting, find your passion. I'm not going to help you any further than that.
And they told him in the hospital that he was they were going to have to cut his arm because he was getting infectious. And like any good GC would do, he ran away through the window. And he taught himself to play guitar again with this new hand. And instead of it becoming a handicap, thanks to that, he invented a style. Because so he couldn't do any more of these chords, like with the fingers all spread out like this. So all his chords were kind of bar chords and sounded like a thump sound. And so he invented this thing called a pump, which is a gypsy pump, is a way to accompany that sounds kind of like a freight train. And so he was the creator of this style. And so he finished his years in the village where I grew up. And every year there's a Django Reinhardt festival in his honor. And gypsies from all across Europe, including his family, come in their caravans and they set camp in the fields by hundreds during the period of the festival to honor him and to go to his tomb and put some flowers. And during this period, they play guitar nonstop. And so ever since I was a little girl, I would go to this festival because it was free for little kids. And I was going there just because, you know, they had Nutella crepes and everyone else was going. And so I heard this music ever since I was little, but I didn't really care about it. And I knew I loved music because my parents put a lot of music in the house to dance to, a lot of Michael Jackson, a lot of Latin music, and so I always loved music, but I also wanted to be Indiana Jones when I was little. and then one day I was around 13, and so the gypsies have kind of a bad reputation because they're different. People are always scared of what is different. They don't go to school, they live in caravans, and you know, they come in the village and the village becomes full of gypsies, and so village people are not okay with that. And so they stay among themselves and the non-gypsies stay among themselves. And so when I was 13, I was riding my bike in San Juan, the little village, and a young gypsy girl came to me and she said, "Madame, play up!" And I couldn't understand her. They have a very funny accent. And it took me several times to understand that she wanted to borrow my bike. And I said, "Sure." And then she called her three cousins, and they all four of them hopped on the bike and said, "Come on!" And so I hopped on the bike with them, and we went down my street, which is cobblestone. And then we just became friends. And from that day on, I became completely obsessed with the gypsies and their lifestyle and their way of seeing life and how different they were. The more I discovered differences, the more I fell in love with them. And so they felt the same with me. They accepted me in their campsite, and they were jealous when I was in the caravan of the other girl. The other woman was like, "Come to my caravan now, you know, you spent enough time in her caravan." And so they were very fascinated with me as I was fascinated with them. And I had this new video camera, and I filmed them washing the clothes outside, and tuning the guitars, and washing the caravan. They're very clean. They wash all day, every day. And I started to get curious about the guys playing the guitars. And when I would go and to see the brothers playing the guitars, the women would be like, "You can't hang out with the men, you know, that's not what we do here, women. Hang out with women, men hang out with men." And like, "Yeah, but this guitar is interesting." And so little by little, I became friends to the brother of the first gypsy girl who I had met. Her name was Smurfette, and her brother is Fiu, which means kind of a troublemaker, I guess. And we started becoming really friends, and he started to teach me the guitar, and in exchange, I would teach him to read. And I remember sometimes his parents would ask me to fill in their social security papers because they didn't know how to read either. And so we spent a lot of time like this, and we started to play the guitar, and me teaching him how to read, and the townspeople started to tell my parents, "We saw your daughter hanging out with gypsies, you know, you gotta be careful, they're gonna take her away and marry her or trade her for some goats or something." And so I was grounded, and I was not allowed to go and see them. And so then Firu would come out in my backyard at night and whistle, and I would go down the window, and then we'd cross the forest together and end up in the campsite where there was a big fire and the women cooking and the kids dancing everywhere and 12 guitars. And then in the morning, I would go back to my room, and the neighbors started complaining about the whistling, so he gave me a flashlight. And I kept getting grounded, and I kept going back. And one day, Philo's big brother, he was a virtuoso of the guitar, and he knew that I took English in school, and so he put on a song for me, and he's like, "I want you to learn this song so we can play." Like, "No, can you please learn this song?" Okay, and so it was a song called "Sweet Soup." And I remember it was raining, and so we couldn't all fit in the caravan. So we all went into this bus that was the Samba bus that was parked there, but the guy left it open. And so the whole gypsy family went in the bus, and you could hear the rain on the roof of the bus, and the Dallas, which was the big brother's name, because when the mother was giving birth, she was seeing the series Dallas. Dallas. So she called him Dallas. He started to play, and I sang "Sweet Sue" in front of the whole family. And when I saw the smiles on people's faces and the excitement and the peace and the joy that it brought to them, and for me it was much more direct than, you know, when I had a guitar, I was looking at the guitar, but here singing, I was seeing all these faces that. And this moment stayed with me forever. And there was never a moment where I told myself, "Okay, I want to be a singer," or "I want my career to be a professional singer, a jazz singer." No, I just felt I want this feeling. This is the feeling I want. However, whatever that means, if it means singing for maybe 2 years and then it brings me somewhere else, I don't know where it'll bring me. But this is the feeling I want to follow, not something concrete like being the best singer or being the most famous vocalist. Just doing this, making people smile, making them happy with whatever I can do. And at that moment, singing is what I could do. So from that day on, I just wanted to sing every chance I got. And then at some point, my parents saw there was nothing they could do about it. And so now they're friends, and the gypsies come and in a line with their towel and their shampoo, and they take showers in my house. And so I think when, especially in the arts, when it becomes, you know, because at some point, you know, I sang a lot and I wanted to pursue it, and I think, like John said, if you're always in the mindset of learning, wanting to learn how to keep this feeling alive and how to, you know, make people happy, which is what for me is what keeps me looking for how more ways to do it. As long as you're in that mindset of always learning, it'll take you to the most amazing places. If you're always wanting to receive and never sitting on your comfort zone. As soon as you're in your comfort zone, you're just waiting to die. Yes. Sorry. Sorry. And so after this, I went to New York to study jazz, and I've been playing all around the world, and there are some moments, you know, when it becomes a job where you forget the main reason why you said you wanted to do this. It's not because you wanted to make money. When you're a little kid, you don't dream of jobs that make money. You don't dream of buying things, and so it's important to think back on your young self and always remember this feeling that made you go to the, you know, made you see this direction you wanted to go to. And I was starting to forget it. Living in New York is a very tough town. And I realized that I needed something to challenge me again, because I've been in New York for 10 years, and 10 years ago I went with the aim of just playing with all my favorite jazz musicians and getting my butt kicked by some singer that could scat like crazy, and getting a record label and doing an album. Now it's been 10 years, I've done 8 albums, I played with a lot of amazing musicians, and I'm still doing that, but I wanted to find something that challenged me more, and just in the past few months, I found another thing that I'm not good at yet, but I can feel that it feels good when I'm trying hard on it, which is playing the guitar and writing songs. And so I think to always look for something to challenge you is, you are in your passion. It's not like there's the end goal is to find your passion. Finding your passion is a day-to-day thing, meaning being open to receiving whatever comes to you.
School system didn't have a jazz program. I didn't know anything about jazz anyway, because my family was not musical. You just heard what was on the radio, right? So I started at 13 on the saxophone through the school system. I was tall for my age, so the music teacher gave me a baritone saxophone so that I could carry it in marching band. So that's how I got started in music. From there, I began to play alto saxophone and studied the classical repertoire for saxophone. There's an incredible tradition of classical saxophone in France, from Francis, a wonderful, wonderful musician named Marcel Mule, that sort of created a whole way of playing the saxophone. And at the same time, I began listening to jazz on recordings. I grew up in Delaware, which is near Philadelphia. I had a neighbor that had a wonderful jazz collection, and he heard me practicing. Our houses were next to each other, and he started to lend me records. I studied classical saxophone, and I learned how to play jazz by ear from records. Very similar to Priscilla, I got to a point where my mother realized I wasn't going to quit, and so she joined the Columbia Record Club and bought a little stereo record player for me. I grew up out of the Sears Roebuck catalog. So the Sears Roebuck catalog always had this incredible music series, all kinds of instruments, all kinds of equipment for music. It was called Silvertone. So I got my little Silvertone record player. My mother joined the Columbia Record Club, and the first record is always the freebie, right? It's always the new one that year. And the first record that year that I got, my first jazz record, was a Miles Davis record called Kind of Blue. That's one of the great classic jazz records. On that record, I heard John Coltrane, and it was like sticking my finger in a light socket. It was incredible. It was an incredible feeling. It wasn't the notes. It wasn't sophisticated harmonies. There was a sound. There was something very, very deep that touched me very deeply. And so from that point on, that's all I wanted to do was play the saxophone like John Coltrane. So I took my allowance money, I took my lunch money, and every week I would buy a John Coltrane record, and I would play my records on my little Silvertone record player. It had a stacker, and I put like three or four records on every night, and I'd go to bed, and I'd go to sleep listening to this music, listening to John Coltrane at a very low level. So basically what happened was I trained my subconscious mind to hear musically and intervallically in a particular way. And before I knew what the chords were, or I knew what the harmony was, I could play in that way related to the energy. When I graduated from high school, I was playing with different bands. I was still playing classical saxophone, and I played with a very famous French saxophone piece by Jacques Ibert called the Concertino de Camera when I was about 16 with the Symphony in Our Town in Wilmington, Delaware, where I grew up. And so I was doing that and learning to play jazz by ear. And that's the way my whole life has evolved. By the time I was 16, I knew I wanted to be a musician. By the time I was 16, I considered myself to be a musician. I never thought of myself as being anything else from the time I was that age. So I had made this commitment. And because I had made this commitment, all of these things came in line, you know. So I call it, it's a series. Your life is a series of little miracles, things that happen. You're one place, you're doing something, somebody comes up and says, oh wow, can you come over to my house and do this, and then you meet somebody, and that's the way the whole thing evolves, you know. So I went to college in Pennsylvania for a year, it didn't work. Then I won a scholarship to the Berklee School of Music in Boston. I was there for a year and a half. Then I got asked to go on the road with Buddy Rich's band, which was a very famous band at that time. That was like 1966. So Buddy Rich was had a member of his band that left. And so they called Berklee to see who they could get for a week or so until they got to New York and got a real adult musician. So by the time they got to New York, I was still there. I was there for like 2.5 years. And things evolved in that way. You know, I moved to Los Angeles. I started doing the Tonight Show and all kinds of different things in the California music business. So I learned a lot about the music business. And at the same time, I learned a lot about the craft of music. And at the same time, I learned about who I was and what I wanted to do with my music, you know. But it takes a while. You know, I was probably 35 years old before I realized what I really wanted to do. But up until that time, I was learning all this craft, and all the pieces were coming together in order for me to do, to fulfill what I want to do. So now, you know, I'm doing mainly my music. I travel continually, and it's to do the music. It's to carry the music. It's to carry the belief that we have. I have a basic belief, which is we're all a part of the same energy. There's one energy that connects us all. We're all brothers, we're all sisters. I believe that is infinite energy, and it works through everyone related to our acceptance of it, to our acknowledgement of it. And so I'm going to keep it really short. I've got 8 words for you, and that is, it is done unto you as you believe. That's how the universe works. That's how life manifests. The thoughts that you have, the concepts that you have, the words that you say, the things that you believe, manifest on the physical plane as your life. That's how the universe works. Everybody talks about body, mind, spirit, but it works spirit, mind, body. Concept, idea, words, things. And everything you see and everything that you touch was somebody's idea. And everything you do in your life and what it is now is related to how you think about yourself in relationship to the world. So, your passion has found you. The most important thing is to listen. Be able to listen. When you get a message, when you get a signal, when you hear a voice, when something happens right in front of you, and you say, wow, what a coincidence. These are things. This is energy moving through you. If you make the recognition, then other things evolve. And that's why I say our life is a series of miracles, one after the other. And we all live in a world of miracles, if you allow it. So, we should go on.
Woo!
Question, raise your hand, we'll give you a note card. And we've had a couple of questions already submitted, so I'll just start with that. For David, sometimes we aren't in touch with our hearts. If our hearts have shut down into depression, how can we show ourselves that finding our passion is even possible and worthwhile? Can we do that for ourselves, or do we need others to show us?
Wow, fascinating question. When we're in depression, how do we show to ourselves that finding our passion is even possible? When I am in that state of mind that says that there is no significance in what I can offer, when I'm in that state of mind of that kind of helplessness about I don't know how to feel like I matter. It's always the medicine for me to go listen to music. I know that output equals input. I know that my job seems to look like I play music, but my job is to be inspired. And when I'm feeling like I don't have anything to offer, instead of, trying to squeeze water from a stone, I know that all I need to do is go hear music that I've never heard before. And people ask, what's your favorite kind of music? And my favorite kind of music is live music. It's like I have a friend who, somebody asked him, what's his favorite kind of cookie? And he said, hot. So my favorite kind of music is live music, preferably stuff I've never heard. And so I'm the kind of person who, when I need that inspiration, I know that I just have to go out beyond the usual places and hear something new and be surprised by it. And I think that for me, that's just a way of saying, this is the place where my heart is most susceptible. This is sort of the angle that my antenna is aimed at. I hear music. And I know that there are things that I can't really perceive the emotional value of. I've walked through the greatest art museums in the world, I think, ooh, that's pretty. Oh, I like that color. This and that. Nothing has ever said to me, my life is different now. There's never been a painting that has changed my life. So I know that it's a particular frequency that we're tuned to. For me, it's music. So when I need to get out of, when my life is too small, I need to get into a sense of life being bigger and mysterious and possible and fun. Music is the thing for me. So I go hear something that's new, that's surprising, that stirs me. Anybody else want to speak on this? How do we get our possibility back when we're feeling stirred?
It is quite difficult because it is just, it's impossible to achieve what you cannot perceive, because everything comes from mind. So how can you change with the same concepts in your mind? You can't. You know, it's like, that's why sometimes things are going on and we don't even recognize them. You know, there's a famous video of a basketball game and a gorilla runs through it and nobody sees the gorilla.
Yeah.
You know, like they have to see it like 5 or 6 times, and then all of a sudden they see this guy in a gorilla suit running through this basketball game. So it's perception, right? How do we change our perception? The only way we can change our perception is to teach ourselves to look at things in a different way. And it takes practice. That takes, you know, that's not, it's simple, but it's not easy, because we have to say, well, just because I think that doesn't mean that it's real.
Yeah.
You know, it's like my truth is not the truth, it's my truth. And there is no the truth, because the truth is everybody's concept of truth. What is real for you, that's your reality. So then, if your reality is not working for you, then you have to systematically work on changing your reality. And that's quite a bit. That's a lot of work. But if it's, all things come from desire. If you want to change, you can change. You just have to take the first step towards change, and then you change.
Question from a student for John. You said at one point you were finally being challenged in the right way. Do you think there's a wrong challenge for somebody?
That's a good question. For me, the being challenged in the right ways came down to a few ingredients. Was a challenge a healthy challenge for me? Would it keep me healthy mentally and physically? And so I think I can see a challenge being a wrong challenge for somebody if some aspect of that challenge requires unhealthy decisions, whether it be to take drugs to stay up, to get on stage, or whatever. Like, there are all these different ways that can possibly negatively impact whatever you are pursuing. Or are you sacrificing things in your life that are dear to you? Family, for me. I guess I knew there are a lot of polar explorer type people out there, adventurers, people who are on the road away from home quite often, who had fractured family lives. And when I started out, I said, I do not want to be that person. So I made decisions along the way to take my foot off the pedal to make sure I found the right person to marry and start a family. So I think that those sorts of things were in the back of my head. So I think about the people I'm with. Are these people positive people? Do they have similar motivations for doing whatever we are doing that I do? And do I reconnect on that level? Like choosing teammates who we're going to spend a lot of time with in a very remote, claustrophobic location. Or choosing teammates, you know, at home as well, whatever your endeavor is, those people will impact your experience so much. And I think we're like very, very careful about who we select to go on expedition. That's one of the reasons I don't guide that frequently. Sometimes those teammates are chosen for me, and it can end up being a hellish experience if we don't line up. So I look at kind of those, like, what are my values and our situation that I'm finding myself in, do they line up there? So I think, sure, challenges, you don't always choose what your challenges are. And I think if a person finds themselves being challenged in a negative way, there's always interpersonal speed bumps and things that don't go as planned. And those can be a difficult thing sometimes, but if you are attached to something bigger than yourself, the team, the goal, and you have that connection, I think it will work out in a positive direction. Even though you may not know what that next step or that future path is going to be. So I think connecting with values and having sort of a baseline game plan, like what are my bottom lines going into this endeavor of life choices? What do I always want to have? Family? That sort of thing. I think that can kind of keep me in the right track.
Thank you. No question.
I guess there's a dark side to passion. Here's a question we just have. I've been successful in a passion that I pursued, yet it manifested in inspiring jealousy in family and some friends. What do you suggest, other than the gypsy method of jumping out the window and running off, to deal with jealousy in the shadow of passion? Anybody?
Life is experiential. A lot of things you can't find out about until you've tried them. You don't really know how something is going to affect you until you go through it. So if you're in a family and there's a lot of resistance, then you stay there, you deal with the resistance, and you deal with the lesson of the resistance. If you deal with the lesson of the resistance, it's an amazing thing how the resistance will dissipate itself if you embrace it rather than fight it. You know how it works when you get resistance. Then you react with resistance, you push against it, it pushes against you, and then the whole situation, the whole concept is pushing, pushing, it gets harder, and then at some point something cracks. You know, we're living through that right now, right? We're seeing these things happen. You know, we're seeing these mistakes being made, and then we're seeing resistance, and then we're seeing resistance to the resistance, and then we see the break, right? It's all family. We're all family, you know, and we're all learning from our experiences. So if you're in a family situation where you believe something and you're getting resistance, then for me, the best thing is to just continue in your way and also honor the other person's resistance. You know, if you can say, oh yeah, I understand that, and that's your concept, and I understand your concept, and this is my concept, and I ask you to understand my concept as I understand yours. If you don't understand my concept, that's not my problem. You know, that's something that you have to work out. You know, you have to work that situation out, because this is what I am. And I don't see it working any other way. And that's what we're finding out right now, right? It's like, does anybody know about the Hermetic philosophy? Hermes Trismegistus of, I don't even know if I'm pronouncing it right, because I've never heard anybody say it, but ancient Egypt, had this mythical teacher, somewhat like Lao Tzu, or other people that are these mythical teachers, and everybody write books and everything about, but they're not really sure if they were guys, right? Because all their ideas were so good, so continually, how could anybody be that right all the time? So they come up figuring out, well, it's a whole bunch of guys that put their ideas together, and they put it on, and they put this cover on. Well, this guy Hermes created he codified the law of cause and effect, right? As above, so below. What goes around, comes around. You know, what you do comes back to you. And all those 500 million things you've heard. Well, guys, it's true. You know, it's 5,000 years old and it's true. And we keep repeating, you know, we keep repeating the same lesson because we haven't reached critical mass yet. When 51% of the people on the planet believe that it is done unto you as you believe, what you do comes back to you. When we get 51% of people that believe that, then we have a paradigm shift. You know, the 100th monkey and all that stuff, you know, where everything flips over and everybody changes. Obviously, we are not there yet. But it's cause and effect. So we're all dealing with that. And we're dealing with that in our families, and we're dealing with that in our lives, and it's over 5,000 years old. I mean, they say it came from Egypt, but it probably came from Samaria before that. If you study Samaria and that whole thing, you know, and it's another, that's another class.
Can I reply to this person who has a question?
Mm-hmm.
I think for that person who said that they are successful in what they do and they have some jealous people who they care about because they wouldn't, you know, be worried about the situation if they didn't care. I think the issue is not about you don't have to fix anything. You keep doing what you're doing. That person is lacking, you know, their passion. They're jealous because they don't have their passion. And I have a little sister, and for her it was difficult because the only example she had was a big sister who found her passion when she was 14 and just didn't look back, and she's 28 now and she's just starting to know what she wants to do. So she, for a while, there was some jealousy there, and I think the best thing to do if you care about this person is to help them in their path to finding their passion, and help them overcome their fears. Because it's funny, I realized that none of us spoke really about fear, but fear is one of the biggest walls that you put in front of yourself that blocks you from finding your passion. And so if you can help this person be more open to finding their passion, first of all, they will be more sensitive towards you and, you know, less resentful, and then it will help them in their life as well.
Thank you.
Surreal, you just answered one of the questions. I just want to read it out for the benefit of the writer. And they said, what is the balance between the head and the heart in the search for work? And you were just addressing face your fears, supporting the people around you if they're jealous. So that's that question. We're not going to get to all the questions, but somebody asked a really great one. Surreal, could you please sing for us?
Yesterday.
So rewind this. Then we do have one more question then. Is it harder for girls or women to follow their passions in this world?
You have something to say, Joel?
No, I was going to give it to you. It would be difficult. I thought you had an answer.
I think we have some harder, there's some things that are harder for women, but also for guys too. I mean, you know, a pretty girl sells more than a pretty guy, I think. And so we have some I think it's pretty balanced. I mean, it really depends on how you see it. But we shouldn't go at it thinking that we're less strong, for sure, you know, because that brings back the fear factor. And I think when you see successful people, we tend to think, wow, they're so lucky, everything turned out so right in their life. And the people who make it to the top are not the people that never fell down. It's the people that every time they fell down, they got back up. And they fell down a lot. And so it's just about getting back up every time.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you guys.